Folks, let's get rolling with this conversation.
Hello, my name is Emma Lugo, and you are listening today to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're going to be listening to a community forum recorded recently at Portland State University with Wael Esade and also Julia Ford.
Wael Esade, who is a PSU alum, as you saw in the poster, and kind of from what I remember, consider still the golden age of super activism on campus. Their legendary kind of weekend-long conferences that blew away anything that happened at PSU in those days. And
I'll just start by saying the question that Jose asked me to talk about, which is what is the outlook and what are key insights for our work towards justice in Palestine after Trump? I sat down and tried to write that, but before addressing that, I realized we need to start by asking a more basic question. How the hell did we get here? How did Trump win? In 2016, the Democrats could arguably say that they were caught off guard, that Trump was an unprecedented political phenomenon, right? But this time they had 8 years to prepare. They knew what was coming. How could someone with such a chaotic record, a presidency marked by over 1 million COVID deaths, somebody who said that people should, you know, maybe drink bleach, right, to deal with COVID, who was impeached twice, who's a convicted felon, who the entire establishment, after trying to lead an insurrection to overturn an election, labeled him as a proto-fascist, and then who was pretty soundly defeated in 2020 by Joe Biden by substantial margins. How could he win? But not just how could he win, but how did he win so convincingly? Right? Many of us, I think, in the days leading up to the election, were bracing for a nail biter, anticipating another Trump attempt, maybe, and his loyalists to overturn a close election. But instead, Trump swept the swing states, every single one. He won the popular vote. He gained ground across nearly every demographic, and even in cities and regions long considered untouchable Democratic strongholds. And most worryingly, for the third consecutive election, Trump increased his total popular vote count. The liberal establishment was stunned yet again, like they were in 2016. Yet the warning signs had been there for months. Polls in the year leading up to the election consistently showed that Americans were angry about inflation and the economy. A majority said their families were worse off than they were 4 years ago, right? That famous question by Ronald Reagan that was asked. But Democrats and the media establishment largely dismissed this discontent, right? They pointed instead to traditional metrics like strong GDP growth, low unemployment, and the slowing down of inflation, often dismissing it as what was being called a vibe session. That word was thrown around all the time about what majority of people were facing. But Americans weren't actually imagining their struggles and what was happening in this country. They were seeing rising rents, grocery bills that required second jobs. I mean, I felt this. Our grocery bill with three children literally went from $150 every time we went to the store to $250, $300. It was incredible. And a real sense of uncertainty for their futures and for their communities. But it is worth kind of remembering also what was happening 4 years ago, and that honestly seems like a lifetime. I couldn't believe that it was just 4 years. But just 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders had put together a massive multiracial coalition that almost defeated Biden's campaign by popularizing policies like Medicare for All, student debt relief, a Green New Deal, and ending the forever wars. People remember that? I mean, do people remember Nevada when he won that primary, what it felt like? The Democratic Party did everything in its power to defeat Sanders' primary challenge. But even though they did, they were forced to take on some of his popular left-wing policies. So when Biden was elected in the aftermath of Trump's catastrophic handling of COVID, he entered the White House with a mandate for bold change. And for a brief moment, he actually delivered. He pulled troops out from Afghanistan after 20 years of that war, and he passed the American Rescue Plan, which included sweeping measures that gave Americans a rare glimpse of what life under a compassionate, functional government might look like. Evictions and foreclosures were banned for that period, were paused. Unemployment benefits were increased and they were expanded. The child tax credit was expanded so parents, we received $300 for every child to offset the cost of child care. Free meals and schools were introduced into public schools. SNAP benefits were increased and eligibility was actually expanded to more Americans. Medicaid was expanded and student loan payments were paused. And there was a serious discussion happening about actually getting rid of student loans altogether. For the first time in a decade, millions of Americans felt a fleeting sense of stability. Right, even in the midst of that horror that was COVID, for a brief moment, that stability existed. But rather than build on this progress, the Democrats let it crumble. Instead of cementing these gains, the expanded benefits were allowed to expire. The once ambitious Build Back Better agenda was gutted into an infrastructure bill that did not do anything to touch people's daily lives. It was more about growing the economy in the long term. And at the same time that this was happening, inflation, driven partly by corporate price gouging, hit its worst level since the 1980s. And rather than fighting on their own social programs, for the Build Back Better or curbing corporate excesses, the Biden administration pivoted after their initial defeats to a hawkish foreign policy as their political solution out of this. They funneled billions into weapons for the war in Ukraine, and after October 7th, massively increased military aid to Israel, enabling its genocidal campaign in Gaza. So as the social programs were unwinding, by 2024, Biden's military spending request reached $900 billion, rivaling the heights of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars that the Democrats had vowed to end. And by the time Americans returned to the voting booth, student loan payments had restarted, evictions and foreclosures had surged, food stamp benefits had begun to dry up, inflation had eaten away at savings, homelessness and poverty shot back up to pre-pandemic highs, and the U.S. was supporting an undeeply popular genocide in Gaza. That's the backdrop that Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee for. Harris inherited show. It was a difficult situation, but quite honestly, her campaign was very, very disappointing and pretty disconnected to the reality of most Americans. With this backdrop of this difficult situation, when she was asked what she would have done differently than Biden, Harris had no answer, except perhaps to include some more Republicans in her administration. So while Americans scrape by paycheck to paycheck, Harris's campaign burned through $1 billion, lavishly funding and running celebrity-hosted events and big rock concerts, right, in different places, but really out of tune from where most Americans were in their day-to-day lives. While hurricanes devastated Florida and North Carolina, Harris was reversing her previous positions on banning fracking, boasting in different places when she was on the stump speech that Biden actually reigned over the largest increase in oil production in U.S. history. And during the genocide in Gaza, as Arab Americans across the country were burying their loved ones in Lebanon and in Gaza, the Democratic Party held a dance party for joy inside of their convention while they refused to let a single Palestinian address that convention. And of course, this allowed Trump to again position himself as an outsider railing against the status quo, even as Harris doubled down, right, on defending that status quo and was touting endorsements by the Bushes, the Clintons, and going around and campaigning with Liz Cheney, for crying out loud, as if there was some popular massive upheaval and demand for Liz Cheney in this country. The truth is that the leadership of the Democratic Party has been moving in the wrong direction for decades. Instead of embracing bold, transformative policies that would lift up working people, they clung to the status quo and shied away from a serious confrontation that was needed to transform people's lives. Instead of fighting for a multiracial, working class coalition that Bernie Sanders had helped to build, they chased the votes of wealthy donors and suburban moderates that they weren't actually able to flip. And instead of addressing the housing crisis, healthcare, and climate change head on, they tinker around the edges of these things, and then they want us to just simply vote for them and applause. And instead of taking a moral stance against Israel's genocide and working to end global conflict around the world, they remain complicit and abandon any sense of decency and humanity. People felt that. And the problem is, when voters rejected them, they blamed the people of this country. Quite honestly, the discourse has been almost as bad as the result after this. They blame white men and white women. They blame Latino men for moving towards Trump. They blame black men and then lecture them. They blame Gen Z, right? And of course, they're blaming Arabs and Muslims for what happened. But they never seem to blame themselves. What they refuse to see, or what they're now blaming on wokeness or being too progressive, is that their inability and often their refusal to address the pain that most of us feel just leaves voters disillusioned. And it leaves them actually vulnerable. For some, economic despair allowed them to overlook Trump's racism and misogyny, clinging to the hope that he might bring relief to their struggles. For others, that same despair made them susceptible to Trump's scapegoating, to his blaming of immigrants, to transgender individuals, and anyone who doesn't fit his narrow vision of what America looks like. And for younger generations of Democrats, half measures on climate change have deepened disillusionment. Their policies offer no real hope and left them uninspired to turn out, which we saw a massive decrease in young voter turnout. Similarly, for Muslims and Arabs, the fear of a Trump presidency and another Muslim ban lost its bite as we watched our children and kin get slaughtered by American weapons abroad. The failure to use the leverage of the U.S. over Israel to halt a genocide which could have been stopped in its track, and which we all saw happen in real time for the first time in history over Instagram, utterly shattered trust and left these communities feeling abandoned and betrayed. The Democratic Party's refusal to fight for bold economic solutions and transformative solutions, whether around climate change or very basic human rights, didn't just weaken its base. It made fertile ground for Trump's message and lies to take root. So I also want to say that it's not just about policies. Bernie Sanders didn't just, you know, popularize, didn't build the most popular movement of our time simply by proposing Medicare for all or for the Green New Deal. Those policies, of course, mattered, right? But what truly set that movement apart and what was so inspiring about it was something deeper. Bernie identified the billionaire class as the source of our misery. He didn't just list a whole bunch of solutions, he actually named a problem. He said out loud what we already knew in our hearts, that the system is rigged, and it's rigged by design. And that's why his message resonated so deeply. He named the true stakes, not just winning one election, but reclaiming democracy from billionaires, whether it's Elon Musk or Mark Cuban. And he understood that Americans don't just want a slightly better version of the same miserable system and situation that we currently have, but we want to fight for one that works for everybody, not just the billionaires in this country. Okay, so I just spent a lot of time talking about what the prospect, but not talking about what the prospect for Palestinian justice in particular holds under Trump, so I'll take a few minutes to talk about that. But I spent that time because I think it's important to understand how we got here and where we came from so we don't fall into despair, that it wasn't that long ago that we were in a much better place, and that the reasons that Trump won isn't because everybody in this country is racist, but because we don't have political leadership that can actually win people over and mobilize them and organize them to that. And so But with all that said, I do think we have to understand that it's going to be an ugly, ugly and painful 4 years. It's going to, you know, I don't know what it's going to look like. I think we have a lot coming our way. And so we have to hold on to that vision that I just kind of described of what Bernie represented, and not just Bernie, but really the millions of Americans that supported Bernie and what that coalition represented as we move into the future. I think one of the reasons that this is going to be so difficult is that this is not 2016. A second Trump term is going to be far more dangerous. He's returning more empowered with control of all three branches of power. He has a popular mandate. He didn't win the popular vote last time, or at least he thinks he has a popular mandate. I'll talk about why it's not quite as strong as he thinks. And he is not, they made a lot of mistakes last time. I think they were surprised by their win. They're coming in with a plan this time. And I think, concerningly, the institutions that resisted Trump's overreach during his first term have been hollowed out. The Democratic Party and much of the liberal establishment, after failing to stop him in 2016 and then again in 2024, are less likely to mount more meaningful resistance right now. There is a very serious sense of despair and reconciliation among the people at the top and among institutions, which is very difficult. And finally, he did in his first term, and I don't think we've fully thought this through, it's not just about his control of the state apparatus. It is about the fact that when resistance emerges to him, he mobilizes his goons onto the street to attack any resistance that comes. So we have to be really aware of that. On the level of Palestine, it's hard to predict for Palestinians what Trump exactly will mean. Foreign policy is a tough one, and I'm not going to try to predict it. But I will say we have to take the ideology of the political nominees that he put forward, and we have to take them at their word. They are a signal to the world that his administration will continue the disastrous U.S. support for Israel, potentially doubling down on it no matter the human cost. Mike Huckabee, Pete Hegseth, and Mark Rubio are aligned with the most hardline factions of Netanyahu's government and are vocal proponents of Israeli settlement expansion and annexation in the West Bank and Gaza. These appointments were a clear tip of the, you know, of the hat to not only Israel, but also to, which kind of exposes it, this was really about the evangelical lobby and the evangelical Zionist support that Trump has at his base. This was kind of, you know, he's very transactional, so this is, we'll give you this as a prize. And that's not just about individuals, right? These individuals, it's a blueprint for policy, including support for annexation and dealing a death blow, which, of course, Democratic administrations in years past had helped along by allowing settlements to expansion, but they want to deal a death blow to the idea of a Palestinian state for once and for all. And the Netanyahu government has kind of acted accordingly and is trying to get ahead of this. He sacked Gallant, the head of the army there, because he was opposed to staying in Gaza and wanted a non-Israeli force to run that. And they have now been speaking openly about annexation of the parts of the West Bank where the settlements are at. Now, this doesn't mean that Trump's going to let Israel expand its wars. He has a genuine isolationist wing in his party to worry about, and I don't think he wants to see a massive expansion of war with Iran in the first months of his administration. Again, this is speculation, but it does seem like something that's crystallizing, and I think where a real danger emerges, is they are going to try to get a ceasefire in place in Lebanon, unwind things with Iran and with Hezbollah, and say, you know, the red line for Israel is don't go there, but you can have essentially Palestine and Gaza, and then, you know, we'll talk about some kind of solution in which it's really just Bantustans that maybe will make up a quote-unquote state, which won't be a state. They'll have no sovereignty, no political rights, and so on. And so that seems to be potentially the play, but we don't know. I mean, the Israeli government is full of, chock full of hardliners. I mean, Gallant was a Likudnik. He was very far right already and an architect of the genocide in Gaza, and he was sacked. So the people that are left are literally the worst kind of settler colonial expansionists. And of course, I think Julia will talk more about this, but the threats to us here are incredible to our movement. That's, I think, the bigger change. There's probably a lot of continuity with the Biden administration in terms of what it means for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. But here, I do think we've got something serious coming our way. They're going to be using everything from, what is it, Title VI to try to defund universities if they're supporting anti-Semitism, which we know just simply means any critique of Israel today. And they're going to have control of the different branches of government to do that. Now, I've painted a pretty grim picture. I want to say a few things where there are slivers of hope, and I don't want to do this just but because I think they do exist. One is, it's not hopeless in the sense that this is not, I think, a massive realignment of U.S. politics to the right on the basis of like Ronald Reagan, where Trump has just locked it in for the next, you know, 10, 15 years. This has been a gain for him, for sure, and people have moved to the right, and it's a dangerous another step in that direction. But the numbers show that although Trump's support increased, the larger reason for Harris's loss was actually a big drop in voter turnout among core Democratic constituencies. So it's again that failure that I've referenced earlier to provide a compelling argument for why people should come out and vote. So it doesn't mean, again, that the core of the American people are racist misogynists. There's definitely a core that exists, but even among Trump supporters, a large portion can actually be won away from the side. And on the question of Palestine, we still have a lot of support. I do think, though, because of the seriousness of what we're facing, we have to have very serious discipline this coming around this time for what our resistance. We need to resist. We can't put our heads in the sand. There's going to be space. And quite frankly, Trump's going to be more prepared, but he has a tendency for overreach and idiocy as well. Let's be serious. And that can open up fissures for us to actually organize in. And I think, but we do have to be very serious. I think we have to build broad coalitions. Now is not the time for ideological purity tests or narrow organizing strategies. Not everyone has to agree with my theoretical position on the colonial settler nature of Israel or not. Not every single one person has to agree on a one-state or a two-state solution, quite frankly, even. What people have to agree on is that genocide is bad, that ethnic cleansing is bad, that the U.S. should end its weapons support for Israel, and that human rights are good. That is the kind of broad basis that we have to build in. And then we can have debates that are patient and open inside the movement about the rest of it to get our bearings. And I think we also have, I think, some healing to do. We have to remember that the majority of people who voted for Kamala Harris are the base of people who are the support for the Palestinian movement. If you look for about who are the people that supported, who were critical of Israel, they voted for Kamala Harris. So yes, there's tension around that, and most of it's on social media. Let's not bring it into the movement. In the movement, let's talk about it. Let's remember that people were put in between a rock and a hard place. And we don't want to throw anyone away. We want to open up our movements and our struggles to discuss things. And I think we have to, especially Palestinians and Jews in this country, have to hold each other tight in this coming period. Trump's ascendancy is a serious danger to both of our people, and quite frankly, for a majority of us in this country. And so we have to continue to kind of work side by side together. I've never believed before that Palestinian liberation, I've never believed more than I do today that Palestinian liberation and Palestinian rights are deeply tied to the rights of Jews in this country, and quite honestly, ultimately the safety of Israelis in Israel as well. So that's some elements, and I think the final place I'll end with is that in addition to kind of how do we fight back and some of these things about broad coalitions and not being narrow and how we do it and focusing on unity and solidarity rather than division, I think, and this is a tough task, but I think we have to say that resistance is not enough. by itself. We resisted, right, the last time around. There were mass resistance, and I think it's going to take a little bit longer for it to come, but it will come this time around. But it is not enough. Otherwise, we will just simply have the same problem a few years later, in which there, because people vote for Trump, that despair is based on the fact that we don't have solutions to the ills of the system. So as we do that, I think we have to figure out how to continue to build independent political movements and alternatives. So it's about building of our coalitions. It's about fighting in the streets, but it's about who are we getting elected in 2026 and 2028 to support Bernie Sanders, bills in the Senate, to support those who support Palestinian human rights inside of the House of Representatives, and who can put together a vision, not just on one issue, but that can bring all Americans together to fight with Palestine as a central element of it. Stop there.
Thank you.
If there's anything that really popped for you in this moment that you'd love to address, please do so before I launch into my shorter but equally me talking at you. I just got a really very grounded, horrific picture of why we are here, and we are here, and all of you are in the room tonight. And I think the reality is we have two options. One is to totally give up, which I don't think any of us feel like is an actual option. We're humans on this earth. So we have to put one foot in front of the other and move forward. And what I would like to take us into for this next phase of conversation is what can we actually do as individuals in this room and as members of our broader community and here in Portland? Because here we are a microcosm of the national climate. We are supposedly one of the most progressive cities, and yet we have got no alignment on Palestine. The number of freaking Black Lives Matter signs on houses, where's all the Free Gaza, Free Palestine signs, right? We are a progressive but for Palestine community, and we have to do some serious work within ourselves to move a needle. And so I am not minimizing the need to organize within a national framework. We need to stay plugged in to strategies everywhere, but we have a lot of work that we can do on the local level amongst ourselves that will impact real change, that ideally then sets a foundation for ripple effects elsewhere. So I'm here, I feel the need to say, like, I'm here as an individual. I also work with Jewish Voice for Peace. I also work with the Jewish Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, but really I'm here as an individual. I'm also from Portland. I've lived here my whole life. I'm older than I would care to admit and what I think of myself as. But what I see across the board in community organizing, especially in Portland, is that we build islands. And those islands are really beautiful, right? Like, they feel good. There's palm trees and you're swinging in your hammock. But the reality is there's an island across the way and it's got the same flora and fauna as yours does. And maybe we start to build a bridge because it looks kind of nice over there and those people were waving at them. But then all of a sudden they plant a tree and we don't like it. And so we start to take planks out of the bridge and we stop talking to each other. And maybe we're doing a lot of the same work, but we're doing it inefficiently because we are not crossing bridges. And we need to stop building islands. And I think to the point of the person in the back, we need to focus on how we come together with the infrastructure that we already have. Who's tired in this room, right? So we really need to come together right now and build collective momentum. And again, it doesn't diminish any of the framework, right? But we have a lot of opportunity. And so what I also think that we need to recognize in the face of this dire sort of trifecta red political situation is that 65% of voters in the United States support an offensive arms embargo and a permanent ceasefire. So we have people power. It is not that individually we are all not aligned on basic human rights, but somehow, our people power is not reflected in the political power in this country. And so that is what I would like to anchor us in, is how do we move our people power to political power? So we will come back to who's running in 2 years. But I think in the interim, we need to also think about organizational power. How do we start to remove our islands and start to build more bridges? And one of the things that I see in Portland in this progressive but for Palestine environment is that you've got organizations like NAACP of Portland partnering with the Jewish Federation, who, guess what? Basically endorsed Trump in all of its glory. So we really need to start reaching out, like across, through, over, under. We need to be building coordinated movements who have shared platforms. Again, the platforms don't need to be synonymous. You can be doing a whole bunch of work over here, but why don't we come up with five or six things that are grounded in basic human rights and recognize that Palestine is truly the intersection of almost every social issue of our time. There is no progressive but for Palestine. Guess what? You're not progressive. You're just not paying attention, right? You are embodying all of the white supremacy that is imbued in all of us, that some of us have done some work to untangle. It's never going to be done. But the reality is, if you're not for Palestine, you are literally not standing for any of the values that you say that you are. So we need to start to build that coalition. And in order to do that, we have to do something called narrative change, which I'm really hoping somebody in this room knows what it is so I don't have to be the one to explain it. Anybody know what narrative change work is? Okay. So storytelling, right, is like, for those of us that are in the nonprofit space or any fundraising space, we're always told, like, you've got to tell a good story. You got to make people care. Narrative change is not telling a story. It is laying a landscape where people are unable to ground in the things that they have believed forever that are not true. So you are basically creating space for mental model shifts at a level that lends itself towards systemic change, right? So we need to do narrative change. And what does that look like when we're talking about Palestine and we're talking about coalition building? It talks about decoupling the myth that somehow Jewish safety is tied to Israel. So there's 55,000 Jews here in Portland. We're small. I think there's 22,000 Palestinians, even smaller. But the reality is, of all the Jews in the United States, 74% of us, I am one, just to say, we've never been to Israel. Or maybe we went one time, right? So like, it's more likely that I've been to Alabama than to Israel. Like, it just, there's no tie. But we are being told that our safety as American Jews is somehow tied to this place that most of us have absolutely nothing to do with. And that narrative has nothing to do with Jewish safety, and it's not being promoted by Jews for the most part. It's being promoted by AIPAC, it's being promoted by the right-wing lobby, it's being promoted by these right-wing religious zealots who would like all the Jews to move there so that then they can either convert us or we could be wiped out, right? It makes absolutely zero sense. So we need to start to combat that narrative, and we need to do it in a way that is super, super coordinated because it runs deep. We also need to undo the narrative that criticizing Israel is in some way anti-Semitic. And those two things are directly tied, right? When you remove Judaism from Israel, you then remove this idea that somehow criticizing a nation state is anti-Semitic. But people are scared. Right? There's a lot of really great people who are doing really good organizing, and they are scared. They feel like, oh, I'm not Palestinian. I'm not Jewish. This is not my, I can't have a voice in this. And we need to undo that narrative too. So we need to start to talk to each other, and we need to talk to each other frankly, and we need to hold not just ourselves and our friends and our family members accountable, but we have to hold these nonprofit institutions here in Portland who have been promoting their social justice platforms for the last 6 years accountable and say, hey, where are you on Palestine? Because it actually doesn't reconcile with the rest of the work that you're doing. And how powerful could we be when I come from like the tech marketing world, which is a juxtaposition in and of itself, convo for a different day, but how powerful can we be when all of a sudden we're showing up to talk to Maxine Dexter and we're not showing up as Jewish Voice for Peace and the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, which is not a 501c3, we're just like 20 people that talk. We're showing up as Unite Oregon, as NIA, as the NAACP, as Urban League, as, I don't know, I'm blanking, Sunrise Movement. Throw out a nonprofit that you're affiliated with, right? All of a sudden we build logos and you show up 20 deep and it becomes impossible for any politician in Portland to say that they are progressive, to say that they represent Democrats, and not actually be representing the will of the people, which again is 65% of us. So that's first. Narrative change, coalition building. And then we have to make friends with all of our elected officials, every single one of them. They need to feel safe, they need to feel seen, and they need to feel emboldened. Merkley, actually, do I agree with him on everything? No, but he's been coming out of the gate hard for us. Why is Ron Wyden being allowed to continue in his current capacity without swarms of people and every mainstream organization saying, hey, you're not reflecting what your voters are asking for? Like, this is absolutely wild. You're out of step, you're out of line. So we need to get every single elected to understand the coalition that we've built is big, it's powerful, and it's not going anywhere. And this all goes back to this idea of a shared platform, right? We need to have more than just Palestine, it's everything. We need to have a shared platform that we're able to hold everybody accountable to. And then the last thing I'll say is I'll just echo YL. We need to have people run for office. We are seeing a really cool thing. We saw it with ranked choice voting. Yeah. I was shocked that that got rolled out, and I was shocked it even like went pretty freaking well. Am I stoked about every single human? No, but do we have the most representative government I think we've ever had, at least in my lifetime? Absolutely. So we need more people to run, and we need to start to threaten these incumbent seats. We need to start to show that people will not continue to stay in power if they do not represent the will of the people, because the next wave is not just coming, it is here, and we are going to support them because we have the people power, we just don't yet have the political power. So how do we go beyond these coalitions that have been in the streets? There's a saying that the left, we work like within ourselves, and the right, they mobilize community. We need to work outside of ourselves. So you asked for concrete examples. There is a group of legislators who are forming right now. They've been recently elected to the Oregon State Legislature. They're gonna form an anti-war coalition. They're writing a letter that we will need every nonprofit in Portland to get on board and sign, basically saying, we need a permanent ceasefire, we need a free Palestine, but they're gonna encapsulate it in a bunch of other language, right? So we need to build coalition around something like that letter first. And if you are affiliated with any nonprofit, come see me after this so I can get your information. And that's how we're gonna start. We're gonna get a whole bunch of logos to support this anti-war committee, Democratic Caucus Committee, and then we will build from there. And then the next thing can happen, and then the next thing can happen. I think the last thing that we wanna do is create more work for nonprofits. And what we wanna do is say, we're already in a lot of existing spaces together, how can we just have a better unified message and essentially like a listserv sounding board so that when something happens, everybody has the trust, which is probably the hardest piece, and is like, yep, I'm on board, I'm coming for that. So we just need to get out of our island silos, which is easier said than done. Yeah. Which have nothing to do with keeping Jews safe.
Right? Yeah.
Nico and then Lawrence, did you have your hand?
Sure. Doesn't do much for the height, but I just want to. What comes up for me when y'all are talking about the coalition building, it's not just a matter of like, oh, that sounds like a good tactic. Like, is anyone else afraid? I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I'm scared in my body. We'll talk about somatic work, and it is a matter of our very physical existential safety to make sure that we have as many people on our side,
yep,
as humanly possible. I think back to June 4th, 2017, when, I don't know if y'all remember, if you've been in the city long enough, but there was a triple stabbing on MAX train, where in response to that stabbing, white nationalism just kind of kicked up its ugly head in this town, and Joey Gibson, who was leading Patriot Prayer, and a number of local fascist groups came together and were really trying to show their power in this city. I was, well, and actually, your dad was there too. Like, there's a number, I just looked up an article and I was trying to think about the number of different organizations that were involved in that. You wrote an article, Jose, for PSU. when we were trying to organize the response back, we knew that if it was just a group of activists alone on the street to protest Joey Gibson and a bunch of fascists, we were gonna get shot. Mm-hmm. So what did we do? We knew we had to go as broad as possible. We mobilized every single nonprofit in town. If you just generally had a damn to give about the environment, human beings, life on Earth, we were trying to talk to you and saying, if we don't stand up and show right now, together, today, that we are more powerful and greater in number than those violent extremists, they are going to take this opportunity to temp check and know that they have the green light. And everyone was scared because there were, I don't remember who it was, but people showing up to protest with guns. I mean, it was mm-hmm. violent and horrific, and I had my child, I was scared to death. But we knew that we needed each other. And so we didn't agree on everything, but we ended up coming out in force, over 2,000 people. We had over 75 groups sign on to the Portland Stands United Against Hate Coalition. And it was friggin' beautiful, but it was powerful. It was more than just a moral compass check of like, what should we do? What tactic should we take? It meant our very safety. And we were able to actually bludgeon them back into the corner of disgust that they belong in. And they couldn't, what we said was, this will not stand in our city. We will not allow it. And we showed them that in force, in number. So when we talk about building those bridges, I still have people, you know, that I can call on. When we did the Children's March, they were from that coalition. But we need to be able to create an environment where we can talk to one another that isn't this sort of like more radical than thou. I mean, there is a real, can I say ugh, that permeates the movement that I kind of can't even tolerate as someone who is a self-described revolutionary socialist. It really does need to be an atmosphere and a conversation of where do we agree? Not starting off of what do I think I know better than you, or where do I disagree and where do I think you just don't know what you're talking about, right? But it really does, the way we speak to each other matters. The way we talk to each other, who we ask to come in and how welcoming we are, and not just in like a polite way, but like I do think we need to get offline, chill out on each other a little bit. Can we try to like get down to our humanity and allow people to show up with all of their flaws? Because I know I wasn't born perfect. Was anyone here? I'm learning. We're all learning. We have to be able to talk to each other and be open to the fact that we might be wrong about some stuff. And the second thing I want to say, I'm sorry, I'll wrap up, is like the question about how we feel in our body, as my hands like shake as I say this, as a trans survivor. I mean like PTSD, trauma. My experience has been that when I have a trigger, I am not fully here. I'm halfway here, and my brain, my body, my nervous system is halfway behind me in the past, living out the moment of what harm was done to me. And if I show up in an organizing space where I am fighting whatever battle I need to heal from back here with the person who says something that may not be perfect, whew, my goodness. But what are we going to do when most of the people in this room have experienced some form of trauma? And the people we want to talk to, left, right, up, down, whatever political spectrum, is also feeling some form of trauma and suffering from that. We have to be able to heal ourselves and take accountability and maybe, you know, like figure out how to do that in our personal time and not take it out in the movement. But I do think these are really good conversations, and I do just want to emphasize the need, like, it's going to keep us alive to work together, so we got to learn how to do it.
I just feel like we would be doing an educational disservice if we didn't mention the two House resolutions. One is going up for vote tomorrow in the House, and the other one was introduced a month ago, but I just learned about it today, so I'm worried that it's going to try to sneak in. So the first is HR 9495, which is called the Stop Funding Terrorism Act. And the idea, essentially, is that the federal government at any time could tell a nonprofit, we have deemed that you are supporting terrorism and we are yanking your status. They don't have to tell you what activities. You have no ability to understand like where their determination is tied. You have 90 days to appeal, but that appeal process is running through the same government that is telling you that your nonprofit status is being yanked. And we did see an iteration of this actually pass under the very first Bush presidency. And the result of that was that nonprofits actually then were liable for back taxes, and people could go after board members, et cetera. So this is very real and very scary, and there are letters that you can sign. And I don't know if we're doing like a sign-up sheet tonight, but if folks are kind of interested in getting plugged in, my sense is probably most people in this room are on 50 zillion mailing lists. But if you'd like to be added to one more, make sure that you give me your email address and I will add you, and you can get spammed with all sorts of things to sign. So that's coming up. And then HR 10067, which is actually, and so messed uply named, the Harris Act, helping Americans by restricting resources to immigrant services.
Oh, wow.
So our new appointee for Attorney General is sponsoring this act. And this one is basically saying any nonprofit who is linked to activity supporting any human being in the United States who is here in any fashion of undocumented nature, undefined, your status will go away. So these are what I would call ladder bills, one to the other. And I say this not to stoke the already very palpable and real fear, but to just be grounded in what we are truly facing. And I would like to like pivot what is stark and bleak with something that I think is a little bit anchored in hope and ideally some things that we can all be thinking about and ground in as we move towards action in the coming days and weeks and months, which I took directly from a training that was given on Monday. It was more of like a very similar conversation. It was at the national level with Jewish Voice for Peace, the Adalah Justice Project, Movement for Black Lives. Did anybody have a chance to go to that? Okay, great, I'm not gonna be redundant. But one of the ending speakers was to me the most powerful of the 2 hours, and it was a woman named Dr. Barbara Ransby. And she basically said, okay, here's our 10-point checklist. This is like, if you're organizing for Palestine, if you're organizing in general, here's the 10-point checklist for what's coming. So the first is that we have to protect people, this idea of safety, even our opponents against our enemies. And we need to be very clear to differentiate. Opponents just disagree, and we can have that discussion. But enemies want to kill us, and so we need to be protecting our opponents. We have to build mass organizing and organizations on a broad and principled platform. We have to struggle through our differences, educate, and engage. Silence does not and will not save us. This one really hit. We have to hoard resources, right? We have to make anything that we have liquid and shore up this very real possibility that our civil society infrastructure is going to be undercut by these House resolutions. So how do we ground in our community and make sure that we can show up for each other? We have to have plans for other ways to communicate. So that's not just get offline because we need to be in person, and that's how you build trust, which I think probably everybody agrees with. It's literally like our safety is going to be tied to having in-person relationships and the ability to communicate and mobilize offline. We need to make plans at every level. So we need to lean in to YL's grounding and how we got here and why we're here and what we need to do. And we also need to think about what are the things that we can do tactically every single day within our neighborhoods, at the county, at the city level. We need to get some people to run for office. That's the call to action, okay? We need to lean into the idea that saying is showing. So it's really easy to be scared, and I'm also just gonna own privilege in this moment. We all come with different privilege. So saying is showing means different things for different people. But stand tall, do not stop. Your buttons, your yard signs, however you can show up for Palestine and for yourself in a way that feels safe, do it. The more of us that do it, the safer it becomes. We have to show our power externally. We need to defend alternative press and mainstream press, although it's getting less and less, that dares to tell the truth. I am very guilty of listening to podcasts or reading The Intercept or reading Common Dreams, and then they put out a fundraising call, and I do not donate. If you have resources, those are the folks to give it to, because they are the infrastructure that we are all going to need to stay grounded in what's going on. Check your people. So this is a don't be silent in a very relationship forward way. Every dinner, every interaction is an opportunity. And I know many of us are tired. It's super uncomfortable. It's hard. You keep trying to move the needle. I have family who are Chabad, so for Jews in the room, it's like a very religious sect. I tried, I stopped trying. I can't stop trying. I gotta keep showing up and keep showing up with love, but basically be saying like, I don't think that what you believe is right, and here's why, and I'm gonna sow some doubt. If nothing else, just keep sowing the doubt. And we need plans. We need to strategize, we need to be organized. We need to get off of our islands. We need to reach across and around and up and down and sideways, to Nico's point, and we need to show up in force. So that was her sort of 10 points for organizing. I chose to take that as hopeful because the rest of the call was sort of like, oh my God. And this is a weird plug, but I do have yard signs in my car outside. So if you want one that says stop arming Israel, come downstairs with me and I will give you one. That's the end of what I've got.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a forum with Wael Esade and Julia Ford. And that third speaker was Nico. And this was a forum that was organized around the topic of the U.S. elections. And what can we do going forward to continue organizing as a community for justice for Palestine? And I'd like to, now with a few minutes left in the show, I'd like to provide my own private commentary. And this commentary is based on my own reflection, and no way does it reflect this event or Jewish Voice for Peace or organizers who put together this forum. I have about 8 minutes left on the show of Radio Zine this week, and so I want to take this opportunity to share my own personal reflection, both on the forum, the election, and what we need to do going forward. So I think that for me, what I'm really seeing coming out of the most recent U.S. elections is that the people who are interested in suppressing the rights of the Palestinian people, the people who are interested in suppressing popular dissent, are using the electoral process in order to do that in a way that is intended to have a specific kind of effect. There's a lot going on in the world right now, and people are really concerned about the upcoming elections and their potential impact on the future. Now, for me, first of all, I have to say it's hard for me to understand how anything could be more impactful than what's already happening and what's happening right now. I mean, at this point, at the time of this recording, the day after Thanksgiving, there's 130,000 Palestinian children who are facing starvation. And they're facing starvation in the north of Gaza because they're not getting any aid. And look at what's happened in look at what's happened in Gaza and in Israel. Israel has bombed, has destroyed 70% of the housing stock of Gaza. It's created 2 million refugees. It's waging war on two fronts now, and it's drawing the United States in, both to a potential larger and larger Middle East conflict, but it's also pulling the United States in a way of fundamentally compromising the civil rights of U.S. citizens. And it's doing this by trying to introduce legislation that would make the very act of criticizing or engaging in acts that criticize or in some way express the First Amendment speech rights of U.S. citizens as terrorism. So there's very dangerous and concerning legislation. I mean, we've seen, we basically saw what the state planned to do in response to popular dissent around the issue this time around. Last year, in the spring of this year, when there were crackdowns on student protest movements across the country, student protest movements at places like Columbia, here in Portland at PSU, and around the country, where people who were organizing and raising awareness about genocide and who were raising awareness about the gross violation of human rights that we see happening in Israel, these groups were labeled as terrorists. They were labeled as supporters of Hamas. The student organizers were threatened with being expelled from college, having their futures completely undermined, because they're doing the very American act of speaking out for justice, which is a protected First Amendment speaking act. And they have gone to this extent in order to suppress popular dissent, because people can see so clearly the horrific, horrifying, everyday realities of what's happening in Israel. And we can see it every day. You can see it in the paper. You can see it on the television. You can watch your news feeds and see what's going on. And it's horrifying. And right now at this time, it's the day after Thanksgiving. And again, I want to point out this article that was in Common Dreams that basically says that 130 Palestinian children are facing starvation in the north of Gaza because for over 50 days, Israel has cut off all aid to these children. And Israel has basically reduced the lives of 2 million Palestinians to utter desperation. And these are people, the vast majority of these people were born after 2006. They were born into a place that they had no control over their situation. And the Israel is exercising collective punishment on the people of Gaza. It's mass murdering them. And it's completely destroying everything that they have. And it's a violation of absolutely every standard of decency, every rule of warfare. It's an utter violation of their rights. And people in the United States are trying to speak out on this. And that's what this forum was about. And people are going to continue to work, and they're going to continue to fight, and they're going to continue to resist, because we want justice for everyone. We want justice for Palestinians. We want justice for people all around the world. And if someone is doing something terrible to somebody else, it's our ethical responsibility to call it out. And that's basically what we're doing. So that was my own individual personal commentary. I'm just trying to fill in the last 8 minutes of the show. I really hope you enjoyed listening to this public forum. And you're listening to KBO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. This was a public forum on Palestine and organizing going forward, organized by Wael Esadeh and Julia Ford. And it was held at PSU. Thanks so much for listening. Hi, this is Emma Lugo. Thanks so much for listening today, and I hope that you will consider giving to KBOO during our special pledge drive. You can give by going to kboo.fm/give. And thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio.